I always dance. Welcome to Radical World, the podcast. My name is Jose Leal, and today I've got Lucid here visiting us for a wonderful conversation. Carlos actually coined this as a fireside chat, and here I am by the welcome, Lucid. Thank you for
joining. Thank you. I appreciate being here. Yeah, thanks a lot.
So we met, what, a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, at a little presentation you were making in Menlo Park to the Rotary Club. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, everybody in that room was completely riveted both by your presentation and how the quality of that presentation and the quality of the work you've done. Mm. And I think most importantly, those of us who spoke after you, after you left, by how unique you are as an individual, your presence, your clarity of what's right, and how you've dedicated yourself to the work you do, and how much it meant to us to have you tell us about it. So, again,
well, thank you. I didn't realize it was received so well. I really appreciate that.
It was very well received. So that the folks who are listening know what I'm talking about, give us a little background on yourself and the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I grew up in Alaska in the forest in kind of abject poverty. And I feel like those two kind of contextual things really are foundational for what kind of moved forward. And then just slowly through my life kind of developed this project in the context of traveling the world and living with some of the remotest people and the poorest people in the world, this project to provide basic necessities in the most difficult situations. So it's a humanitarian project, but it's a kind of multifaceted, trying to provide these basic necessities in extremely difficult situations, but also to empower poor local people, indigenous people, primarily women, to work together and to motivate them both to be beneficial, to show them how to create positive change, but to give like really concrete methods of going about it in their community. So it's also in each of those directions, trying to redesign the fabric, the structure of humanitarian aid, kind of rethinking the idea of groups of people working together to create positive change, but that has been so kind of corrupted and derailed in this century, trying to rethink what that means and how to go about it in a radically sustainable, efficient, and transparent manner.
Well, you bring up radical. I was going to say that in your presentation, you used the word radical. And then we spoke afterwards and I said, well, one of the definitions of radical is root. And that's the definition that we really hold on to, because we think that human nature, human behavior is really essentially about how we're rooted to our biology and to what manifests for us, right? And we're then given these lenses that society places upon us. You know, it's not something that people know they're doing. They're just teaching us how the world works, and that they teach us what they know. And it seems to me that you, having been brought up where you were, that lens was not placed over you. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I would say that. Like, I think both growing up in the forest, you're really you're in the ecosystem. So the resources available to you are water and wood and these things that are there. Whereas maybe in a standard kind of a city or something, the resources are jobs and highways and automobiles or something. So it brings it back to this really kind of root level, and poverty in itself. You think of it as like not having access to money, which is inherently what it is. But some of the most creative and innovative people in the world are working with that adversity of not having access to money and then coming up with really incredible solutions and using things that are easily available to them. This whole project is made out of recycled materials, partially because it's really environmentally sustainable, but partially because I started from this this lens of poverty, of what things are available that are that I can make stoves or a tent or whatever out of. So there's this kind of freeing aspect of being underneath the traditional framework of civilization. And then just as a very young child, I didn't have like structured parenting or telling me what to do or that I had to go to school. I just kind of made it up for myself. So the rules were really, what's possible, do what's possible. And so coming from the forest and from this lower economic world that so many really creative people are born into, and then just have at it and do what you can, it really led me in a lot of really interesting directions.
One of the things that really stuck out to me, talking to the other folks that saw that presentation of yours, was how struck they were by the fact that you were able to do this as an individual. Right? It's like, how did you do this? How is this possible? How do you? And I thought about that quite a bit because I didn't have those questions for me about you. I was like, yeah, he's doing what needs to be done. And their questions stemmed, I think, from that fiat lens, what we call the fiat lens, which is what you said a minute ago, to being told what to do, what's doable, how you can do it, and, you know, being dictated that the world requires somebody else to tell you what can and cannot be done.
Yeah.
Right? And obviously, you don't come from that place, as you just said. And what I'd like you to tell us a little bit, because I want a bit of that story for people to understand of what you've done about the building of the tents and the stoves and, making that stuff locally and the resourcing the wood to burn and all of that stuff. Can you give a bit of a snapshot? Because I think it is a remarkable story, though I think it's extraordinarily remarkable with the fiat lens, but only a remarkable story with the radical lens.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I guess all these points you bring up about how perhaps in traditional civilization, you're growing up in a suburban life and you're going to school and all of these things, you have authorities. There's authorities around you who are telling you, whether it's the school principal or the teachers or your parents or whatever it are, they're saying, well, you're just a kid, you'll know when you're older, or you should do this, or you can't do that, you have to sign up for this class or whatever. And I suppose I just accidentally didn't have any authorities. Like I barely had parenting. So who was the school going to call and say that I was skipping class? And the teachers had their own inherent problems, and the society around me was kind of broken. I saw all these problems with the religious structure and the governmental structure and the policing structure. So I didn't have this perception of authorities. So I had this kind of natural rebelliousness where I would respect somebody's opinion, somebody's ability to communicate reality, but there was an inherent framework of authority in my mind from a young age. So I was really kind of undaunted when this whole time people were telling me not to do each next thing that was happening. It was really more a projection for them that they felt stuck in some thing. I accidentally started traveling very young because I was in Alaska. So it seems like just another place, but it's you have to cross Canada to get into the rest of the United States. So growing up in Alaska in the forest and having this kind of inherent rebelliousness, I had to start hitchhiking across Canada as soon as I turned 18. And there's this kind of free, like letting out into the world, and just accidentally started going in all of these directions of working with other groups of quite poor people, serving food, building these mechanisms for helping either like homeless communities or disadvantaged areas on reservations or whatever, just seeing these problems and seeing really tangible ways that through my own like survival and rebelliousness early on, I was going to be able to apply that to being beneficial. So I think, you know, before I say too much, just that idea of being beneficial, this idea of altruism, it I think that there's maybe a cultural framework of some underclass of society that you really need to work together with people and you really need to care about people. Whereas perhaps in this like stratified nuclear family in a city working for a job, you really have this, it's all about me and I'm going to do this next thing and this person might help me, but it's really me and my own trip. And the people living in the forest.
Separation rather than relationship, right?
For sure. The people living in the ecosystem, the people living at the bottom of the economic, socioeconomic strata of society are working together. They're empathizing with each other. They're like caring for each other. And that if that's not there, that altruism, that like desire to participate and to just even understand and communicate with other people on that that basic human level, it's accidentally just been removed from our framework of society. It's been a terrible consequence. And so just reconnecting with that altruism is really kind of super important.
I call I've started to think and call altruism as life serving life. Right. And I think if we look at life and the way that it evolved, it is to serve life as a whole. We seek balance within our environment. We seek balance within ourselves, within our communities. And when balance isn't met, then we go awry. Right. And so how do we go through this process of seeing that altruism isn't a thing we need to try to do. It's a thing we need to allow ourselves to do. And it seems to me that because you hadn't been bound by the things you've just described in society, that you were free to do that. No one said you couldn't help someone else. No one said you couldn't, you know, take your time and take your effort, blood, sweat, and tears, quite literally, and bring it to folks that were in need. I want to tell you a little tiny story. I try not to take too long, but I had these nephews in Canada, actually, and they were wonderful young boys. And at some point, they went to school and they came home, and one of them said, "Oh, I'm not going to do that." And I said, well, why not? You've done this before, cleaning up something, you know, helping me in the shop, workshop. And he says, "Well, you know, you can get paid for working." So it went from something that they loved to do, to work with me in the wood shop, to, well, things like this are work and I need to get paid for it. And it was a shift after school, because now all of a sudden I'm learning that work is something we get paid for and we don't do it unless we get paid, because that would be dumb. It sounds to me like you don't have that belief.
Yeah. Even from a young age, I've always been, you know, primally concerned, centrally concerned with like the experience, having an interesting life, having an interesting experience. And even as a teenager would turn down paid work and to do the thing that I most wanted, the most interesting thing, for free. If I'm having food and a place to sleep and these basic things, having a spectacular life, that's what people work their whole lives and save up money to try to do when they're very old. If I can have a spectacular, very interesting life doing the thing that I want to do, I caught on very quickly that that was the the kind of end result of why everyone was actually trying to save lots of money. And I could just directly for that thing. And when I give presentations at colleges, I suggest the same thing. I'm like, you're not here for job training to try to make the most amount of money. You're trying to understand the nature of reality so that you can engage and participate in the world. And so you can have a really sensational, super interesting life. And it's just a key difference of how you go about being a person that really changes what you're able to accomplish.
Can you take a couple minutes to tell us the story about the Ukraine?
Yeah, I think it is helpful to work backwards, because it was a long, steady process of putting this whole thing together from very simple means, just on a school bus with pots and a park and serving out food, and then moving into doing disaster relief and things. But the Ukraine, by the time Ukraine war started, we had already been doing disaster relief for years and serving refugees, and a lot of this gear had been developed. We had it on two school buses driving around the country to natural disasters and things. So we had a lot of momentum in that regard. But Ukraine was, we couldn't get any of that stuff, any of that gear, those tents, those stoves, any of that stuff over there. We couldn't get many of the people over there. We couldn't access all of the resources that we had. So it was really starting from scratch. So I had seen this war coming for years before it had started through different kind of geopolitical reasonings, and realized that it would be a perfect application of this kitchen, a wood-fired industrial field kitchen that can serve 75-gallon meals without gas or electricity, without utility infrastructure, and that was going to be exactly what was necessary in this situation. So I sent myself over there right at the beginning of the war. And it was just myself with a backpack and ideas. And that was the thing that everybody, even who had been supportive until that point, was like, don't do it. Not only should you not, but you cannot. And so do not try. And it was the thing that was kind of the catalyst for a lot of the forward momentum, because showing up in Ukraine into Lviv on the day of the first major missile strikes in that city, in a country under martial law, air raid sirens, lockdowns, to then just meet the people in a foreign language and design all of the gear in a foreign unit of measurement and purchase basic recycled materials with a foreign currency on the opposite side of the world, kind of in solo, it shows really what's possible for one person to do. And it's, we're so often taught that unless you're in a factory or a military or an industry or an institution, that you can't accomplish anything individually. But it's really the opposite, that individually we are so powerful, just being born with magic passports and the currencies that we have available. If you're born into the United States in relatively good health, you are so incredibly just inherently powerful that you're kind of obligated to use that power in some way, some transformative way, because it's such a necessary moment in the world. And it demonstrated that in a very short amount of time, just showing up in a war zone as a person with a backpack, was able to put together the team and the gear and the materials to make a very large kitchen, this 50-foot wide industrial field kitchen that now, after a year of serving food, we've made 170,000 meals in that country. And we're making these meals at less than 33 now cents per meal, which is on the order of 100 times less expensive per meal than the largest humanitarian organizations in the world. At least in the best cases, dozens of times cheaper. So it's at this point really a great demonstration that just individually, each one of us, without having to appeal to authorities, without having to have inherited like massive power and fortune and wealth, that we can radically change the opposite side of the world in the most difficult situations and vastly improve the lives of an incredible number of people in those places.
That's a beautiful story. And I think it speaks to both who you are, but the ability that we human beings have All too often forgetting that and getting caught up in what we can do and should do and, you know, all of that good stuff. When all the people that were used to supporting you were telling you, not the middle of a war zone, why are you going into the middle of a war zone? What was driving you at that moment? Like, why do that? Because there's enough stuff around here to take care of. There's enough people needing help here in the United States. You drove from disaster to disaster for years to fly to a disaster. Why did you do that?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, beyond that, like, framework of just like empathy and altruism that had started at the very beginning of just whatever it is, what's the biggest part of the fire that I can put out on my own? What's the biggest impact that I can make in the development of civilization and the trajectory of human consciousness that I can make kind of individually? Whatever it is, let's do that thing. It kind of started with that kind of altruistic premise, but then just logistically, the right confluence of things kind of came together in Ukraine that I knew that this project and my particular talents and abilities would be able to be way more effective in that situation than in other situations. So it brings in, I guess, this kind of underlying implication that if you see what's real, if you see reality clearly enough, like, don't let anybody tell you that it's not true. That they let them, like, ask you, hey, can you explain this to me? Like, you should be able to break down what it is you're seeing, but don't let people just step in and say that it's not real. If you see what's real, just hold on to that, verify it, make sure that you know what's real. But when you do, like, really hold on to that and really go for it. And so this confluence of factors in Ukraine, so this is a wood-fired industrial field kitchen. So with just any flammable material, we can cook food, we can sterilize water, we can heat the entire space necessary. It's all made out of locally sourced, recycled, easily available materials. It's run primarily by women in the area who were affected by the crises. All of these factors and so many more little details that support it was this perfect confluence in Ukraine. That 2 years, I made a video about this emerging conflict 2 years before Putin invaded Ukraine, that it was kind of inevitable that this particular conflict was going to take place and that it was going to cause the largest refugee migration since World War II, that they were going to, and I give a presentation about this to colleges about exactly why we, like, Lviv was the space. All of these refugees leaving were going to be needing to go over the Carpathians into the European Union rather than down through the Bessarabian Gap into Romania. They were going to have to pass through Lviv. And it was going to be very cold winters. There's access to firewood, but all of the gas and electricity can either be just shut off by Russia or easily targeted by Russia so that they were certain to have. I thought they would have no gas and electricity very soon, but these, you know, at least half of the time, there's very little access to power. There was this right confluence of things where having a kitchen that didn't rely on electricity and fossil fuels, that was radically sustainable, that could be run by the people in the area, that didn't need an input of gear, that didn't need things to be shipped from the other side of the world, that was able to heat the structure in a blizzard without having to rely on propane supply chains, that could purify water without having to rely on filters being sent in, and so forth and so forth. Each one of these things pointed to Ukraine as being the best use of my particular talents, interests, and abilities and of this project that had been put together. If it would have been Africa or Southeast Asia or Afghanistan or some other place that all of those confluence of things would have come together, I would have been in those places instead. It was just that, you know, all of these people in the world that in these difficult situations, I'm not picking and choosing culturally or on any other ideological basis. It's just based on, like, how can I personally and this project have the biggest impact? And that confluence was in Ukraine at that particular moment.
So one of the things that we at Radical World are hoping to pass along is that as human beings, we have a radical purpose within us, meaning not a specific purpose. I was meant to be a football player or something like that, but a purpose to serve life. And that we can do it in some unique ways. Obviously, you have some unique skills. The engineering of building these very large tents, as the ones that I saw you do in the Ukraine, I think you said they were the largest in the world of that type.
It had come from a teepee, and I had accidentally made the largest teepee in the world and then exceeded the parameters of what a teepee does and had to kind of fundamentally change it to make these 12-sided tents.
So, you know, the idea that we as human beings have this potential in us and that this lens we call the fiat lens prevents us from it fully expressing that potential. One of the ways that we think that is most detrimental to us is how we work. And here you are, someone who has no political, financial, social power, flying into a country that no one there knows who you are. How is it that you were able to get a group of people to come together to do this? The church that funded the food, the people that worked the kitchen, without an authoritarian model of dictation of who needs to do what when, or else they'll get fired or whatever else. How did you do that? And because that's a pure expression of what we were call a radical company, a group of people coming together, being able to work together, not by dictate, not by coercion, but by desire. Can you describe that effort?
Yeah, that's a great framing of that question. I really, I could say so much about it. I think, you know, I've thought about this because I traveled the world and live with these, the poorest people in the world in the most difficult situations. And I could imagine being some business person who's building a part for an airplane engine and is some innovative project. And every person that I'm communicating with is thinking, how can I benefit myself by working with this person? And so all of the interactions that I would have are, I'm trying to get something for myself, and do you want something for yourself so that we can work together if you see like you can get enough for yourself? And it's just so, there would be so much of that. And so many people travel or do their life in that context that it's this really hollow, superficial way of existing accidentally, and they don't maybe realize that there's another way to do it. Fundamentally, foundationally, like I don't get paid to do this work. And so I make sure that I'm working longer hours and harder and more intensely on this project than any of the other people that I'm working with, and that it's clear that I'm not getting money for this project, that this is entirely to be beneficial. It's in the process of it. I have a super interesting life. I have incredible stories. I get to travel the world. I get to live in amazing places. That's my currency, is having an interesting life.
And work with amazing people.
Exactly. But I don't get paid. So I can work with people in the situation where I say, I have this self-evidently really good idea to be helpful that requires that we all kind of work together. And by kind of assembling and communicating with and organizing a group of people who are also similarly interested in participating and being beneficial inherently. They want to, I look for people who will volunteer for the project, people who will put in their time because they like the idea, they feel passionately about helping people in their area, long before I ever mention that there will be money coming into the project and that I will be fundraising and paying women to run the kitchen. There's already been a group of volunteers who are there because of their inherent altruism. And so you kind of touched on something also, that we can go into the most devastated, destroyed situations in the world. I was at the epicenter of the earthquake in Turkey on the Syrian border, living in tent camps during Ramadan. You know, half of everyone's family had died in this event. It was a tragedy. It was a terrible event. But I'm exclusively working with really high quality people in a really like enlivened circumstance, because there's something we can do. We can all work together and do this thing that's benefiting everyone around us. And so it's this positive, like high vibration experience inside of the most difficult, the worst situations in the world. So within this context of not getting paid and working with other people who are also just interested in participating, I'm not their boss. I'm not their leader. I'm not telling them what to do. I'm there working with everybody, doing stuff. And if you know how to work on the engine, then you do that. And if you know how to set up the water system, then you do that. But I'm not your boss. Right. I'm good at some things. You're good at some things. We're working together to do this. And so the group of people that comes out of it feels incredibly empowered, and they see the change that they're able to have. And they know that they need to go and ask someone else how to do the water system if they don't know how to do it. But it's not because that person is their boss or is better than them. They just know how to do the water system. And so it, especially in people in the ecosystem, especially people who are in the lowest economic strata of global civilization, really naturally kind of self-organize into this, you know, not a merit-based, but a participarchy. You are participating on a level that you're able to do the thing, the next thing that's necessary, within this context of altruism, within this context of the empowerment and the interesting experience of radically improving your region, and that has been a unifying factor all over the world.
A word just came to my mind that I heard this weekend at a conference: free responsibility.
Hmm.
That we're free to be responsible.
Hmm.
That we're free to decide what is important in the moment and what we want to do and how we can do it. I thought that was a pretty cool word. So Lucid, I want to really capture, because I think you're the most radical person I've ever met.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Thank you.
I want to capture the sense that I have of you, and you tell me if it is valid, because for most people in our society, we've learned that the way we do the best we can is to listen to those who dictate what we can do, how we can work we can do, what degrees we have in order to do that work, what experience we have, what qualifications we have, and it goes on and on and on. And whenever I talk about a radical company or the ability for us to organize in a different way, the pushback that I get is, but what if people don't do this, and what if people don't want to, and what if people can't? And I understand that those people who have got the fiat lens tightly over their eyes, that they cannot see a world where force isn't the means of relationship, that we need to force each other. Why would you work? Because you have to, no choice, right? If I don't have work, I don't get paid. If I don't get paid, I don't get a home. If I don't get a car, I don't, whatever, right? Like, the system is built to force us to do this type of work. And then when we do the work, the structure of work is forcing us, because we then have to make more money and we have to compete to get further up in the organizational structure. The fact that you're as radical as you are, the fact that you are as connected with what empowers you as a human being, leaves me to wonder if there are things, insights that you have that would help others see what it means to truly be a radical individual?
Wow. I think you're mentioning like the power dynamic in society, and there's probably like very different organizational methods at different layers of, from the national to the state to a city and regional. So there's it's perhaps more complex at this really macro scale and in different language groups or regions and things. And I suppose I can really speak to this. This lower class, this organizational, this horizontal structure is really possible on a group of the 100 people around you or the few hundred people in a community. If you go into a really an impoverished community, there's people there who have been working together horizontally as their natural framework for their whole lives that have never been a part of this hierarchy structure. They'll go and ask somebody for information if they need that information. But as I was saying, they're not superior. They just have this skill or this thing. Right. But inherently being born into like the ecosystem or that lower socioeconomic strata, the kind of underclass, your operating system is this horizontal method. And so in some ways working with in refugee situations, working with people who indigenous communities and remote locations, that horizontal framework is so present that it makes innovative operations. It makes really creative projects just so like ample, so ready to so fertile to take root that it's. I've worked in the college system. I've worked with really rigid institutions that theoretically have access to millions of dollars. And it's just this constant battle of any forward momentum. And right. then you get down into the poorest people, the most remote places, and it's so fertile to put these things together. This project in Ukraine was able to happen because of it was inherently a very poor place anyway. The people who I'm working with are used to working in this very like scrapping together kind of resources that are available and horizontal communication and associations framework. So it was so much easier to put that together in Ukraine during a war on the opposite side of the world than it would have been to do in the United States, where everything is this transactional kind of interaction. Exactly. And we're so formatted for this transactional interaction of like, I don't care what you're doing with your project, that's going to be $150 an hour. Whereas someone else who's in the situation where their community got bombed and they grew up very poor, raising chickens or something, they want to help you because they can empathize. And their operating system is empathy in intercommunication. So there's a lot of directions I could take that question. But I think for one that there's really fertile groups of people and societies and frameworks that we can put our time and our emphasis into, where you might go to some wealthy community in California and you're never going to live long enough to actually interface in the right way to create some really innovative project in that rigid hierarchy and transactional framework, whereas there are places that are just that is their inherent base structure, and that's part of the like the untapped potential of human creativity is really, it's really in this underclass. It's in these marginalized people, in these refugee camps, in these indigenous communities and remote locations. There's the adversity that you're born into in that situation, just in the same way that your muscle needs adversity in order to grow. If you grow up in a very easy lifestyle where you have enough money for transactions, and so everything you do in this transactional life just kind of happens naturally, right. You don't have the challenge and adversity to really be, on average, across a wide population, to be this really innovative, creative, like radically different kind of thinker. It could be that you've done some project that's, again, rooted in what can I get for myself? I came up with a creative idea to get stuff for myself. But in this base layer of people who grew up in abject poverty in really remote locations and difficult situations, the adversity and the challenge and the difficulty and the horizontal framework more often than not creates these pockets of community and specific individuals that are just like hyper capable of visualizing creative solutions to common problems in a way that I don't see among affluent people in other regions. I guess the last thing I'll say is that there's this even in those contexts, the ability to kind of register those people to like the project in Ukraine is possible in large part because of this one woman, this refugee woman, single mother, who is able to receive the money and see the right avenues and post receipts, and who has an impeccable integrity and creativity and ability, and like finding those people, it makes kind of everything else possible, because there might be 1,000 people in that area who are just really eager to help out in their community, but it takes kind of a trained eye and a sensitive kind of ear to find that one woman. Almost always it's going to be a woman that should be in a position of power, leadership, making the critical decisions. Finding that one woman or small group of women who are able to conduct that type of thing, it kind of makes it possible for that otherwise very fertile, creative group of people who have had to work against adversity and challenge to be able to then just have the tools and the space and the ability to solve the problems that they've already been brainstorming and they've already been seeing for their entire lives.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, our time has come to an end. I could talk to you for another hour, but we're trying to keep these podcasts a bit short. So tell us where folks can learn more about you. If Carlos could put up your website, the name of the organization again?
Yeah, Altruist Relief Kitchen is this wood-fired industrial field kitchen that is just made 170,000 meals in Ukraine and is set up in other parts of the world. Altruistrelief.org is the website, and you can access our newsletter, our catalog of back videos, and learn a lot about this organization, some of the things we've done. Get a hold of us through that website, altruistrelief.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much for the time. I want to tell our audience about our next podcast will be released on Monday. And we're still live. Let me say this again. The Radical Pioneers podcast will be released on Monday. It's season 1, episode 4 to be released on Monday, the 22nd. And visit us on radical.world to learn more about what we're doing with Radical. And thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, Lucid, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Both what you do, who you are, and taking the time to come and visit us here on Radical World, the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.